And welcome back to the program. That there was The Cat and the Rooster by Three Leg Torso off their 97 release, self-titled. So you're listening to People Rise Up at 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, USA, online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and we are going to continue our conversation about organic food, agriculture, kind of in a broad sense. We're actually going to shift more now to some of the upstream practices, and in specific, talking about how organic farmers and ranchers can move into what is, I think, fairly unstereotypical role as advocates for the conservation, restoration, and preservation of biodiversity. My guests are Joanne Baumgartner. She is the director of the Wild Farm Alliance, which was created by a national group of wildland proponents and ecological farming advocates who share a common concern for the land and its wild and human inhabitants. Welcome to you, Joanne.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we've also got on the phone Tim Franklin. He is the ranch manager for the Yale Creek Ranch down in Southern Oregon, and he's going to give us some perspective on what it's like to be a rancher promoting biodiversity. So welcome to you, Tim. Little booklet, about 30 pages or so, called Biodiversity Conservation, an Organic Farmer's Guide. Joanne, why don't you tell us what the guide is? It's obviously geared toward organic farmers, so I won't ask who it's for, but what the guide is and why it was created.
Well, the guide was created because the National Organic Program rule requires biodiversity conservation. And the guide goes through about 50 different practices on things that farmers can do to comply with the rule. A few years ago, the major Organic Inspectors Association came to us and said, do you realize that the organic rule actually requires this, and could we help them train inspectors? And so what we did was we put together a committee of organic farmers and certifiers and conservationists and came up with this guide, which you can download from our website. Actually, you can only download the summary, but in a few weeks you'll be able to download the whole guide. But also that committee of experts helped us develop a set of biodiversity inspection questions that then we took to the national guiding body, the National Organic Standards Board, and they amended their model organic inspection form, a form that many certifiers around the country use. They amended that to include biodiversity into the inspection process.
And that was the change this past August?
Yes. Yes, and so the guide is a supporting document for organic farmers to comply with the rule. But it can be used by any farmer. It's just that it does focus in on areas that the organic rule has identified as important.
Okay, and so what are some of the key principles or concepts or practices that a farmer or rancher would do if they wanted to, you know, comply not only with aspects of the National Organic Program related to this, but it sounds like what you're talking about is like a step above and beyond what is mandated. Is that the case?
Well, it is mandated in the rule. The case is that there have always been some farmers that have been doing a really good job, some organic farmers, and some that just didn't know what they were doing wrong or what they could do better. And so this is really a guide that will help bring the whole level of knowledge up in the organic industry. As far as practices, there's everything from farmers can put up bird boxes that attract rodent-eating birds to providing habitat in the form of hedgerows that support predatory insects and pollinators to restoring riverine habitat that filters and keeps our waters clean. And those riverine habitats also serve as wildlife movement corridors, and on a larger scale, some farmers even are taking out marginal land where they weren't making money, where it was a wetland, and restoring it back to its natural state, which helps with flood protection and groundwater recharge. So, and that's just a few of the many practices farmers are doing.
Okay, well, at this point, let's bring Tim back in here. Tim Franklin is the ranch manager for Yale Creek Ranch, located at the confluence of Yale Creek and the Little Applegate River, down in a part of the state I don't get to enough. You guys have 85 acres of woodlands, pasture, and gardens. You raise grass-fed cattle and sheep. You have eggs. You produce flowers, native perennials for landscaping, fresh vegetables, and you also supply some seed companies. So which is it more? Is it more a farm or a ranch?
I guess acreage-wise, you'd have to say it was more of a ranch. There's more pasture than there is cropland.
Okay, how many cattle and how many sheep do you raise?
We have a small herd of cattle, about 40 head, and we've got we run about 22, I guess it's going to be closer to 40 sheep here in the summers, and we have a smaller flock that we keep over the winter.
Okay, so you guys are implementing these practices down on the ranch? Aspects?
Many of them we are, in fact, yeah.
Tell us about a couple of them. One of the things that most people who are aware of criticisms of grazing, specifically on public land, would address is the riparian zone, the wet area around streams. So why don't you tell us something that you guys are doing to promote, conserve, or restore biodiversity on the riparian zones of your ranch?
Sure. We have fenced all the streamside areas where we have active pastures, and we limit or exclude livestock access to those areas unless we're using livestock to help control some of the exotic vegetation. And that beyond that fencing, in our pasture management paddocks, we have a rotational grazing system where we move livestock. It's in a system that roughly mimics how wildlife or any herd animal kind of moves through the environment, so that they graze and then move on and allow that vegetation to regrow. It maintains good ground cover. It maintains high pasture diversity. It helps build soil in the pasture, so you don't have erosion or any kind of runoff issues that you have to worry about even having a vegetation band of vegetation between the pastures and the streams to protect them from any type of water pollution. But then in those areas that we have fenced along the streams, we're working hard to control introduced species that are very aggressive, like Himalayan blackberry.
Okay, well, that's exactly where I wanted to go next, was say, okay, riparian, next thing would be the invasive species. So how are you dealing with those, and what are they that you have down there?
Well, the two major ones we have, we've got the full suite, I think, like any place that's been farmed for over 100 years. But the big major ones on our ranch are yellow star thistle and the blackberry along the streams. And the way we are working on those is for the blackberries, it's a combination of cutting them back and in some cases grazing them back, and then establishing natives that are competitive. And it'll be a constant. There will be a constant maintenance requirement over the course of time, but it'll be manageable, I think, once we get it knocked back a ways. And the yellow star thistle is a combination of irrigation management and grazing management and some mowing that is helping us get a handle on that.
Okay. And now, Joanne, this is this new publication, Biodiversity Conservation and Organic Farmer's Guide. Looking at your folks' website, it seemed like there's somewhat similar, but maybe not quite as fully developed other publications in this vein?
Right. We do have some Wild Farm Alliance briefing papers that address these issues in some depth and different, different ideas. We have one on agricultural cropping patterns, one specifically on water, another one on connectivity, another one on cost share and government and other private public support mechanisms farmers can access.
Now, you just used a term that I think a lot of people may have not caught its full meaning, not necessarily being, strong wildlife advocacy observers or researchers. Connectivity. Tell us what you mean by the word connectivity, because it's got a lot of different meanings based on context.
Well, it's a wildlife movement corridor or linkage. So you think of it as a river corridor, but it can be one piece of land connected to another piece of land by doesn't have to be a narrow strip. It could be a really wide strip, but there's a connection. And ideally, farmers in their watershed work with each other to ensure that those connections are there so that wildlife can move safely through.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guests are Joanne Baumgartner, just there, director of the Wild Farm Alliance. You can find out more about them online at www.wildfarmalliance.org. And Tim Franklin, who is the ranch manager at the Yale Creek Ranch down in southern Oregon along the Little Applegate River. And I don't have a website for them directly, but if you did a search on your favorite search engine in quotes for Yale Creek Ranch, you'll get a couple links. There's one at localharvest.org. And you can also find out about these groups and much more information connected to this issue as well as the topic we covered in the first half of the show at kboo.fm. Go to programs, click Wednesday morning at 10 on People Rise Up, and there you have it. Now, there's many different sections in this booklet here, Joanne. Whole farm diversity, uncultivated area biodiversity, cropland area biodiversity, and then two sections connected to when there's livestock and if you're doing wildcrafting, gathering from nature, mushrooms, or who knows what else. Why would a farmer or rancher, especially if they've got a sizable piece of land, why would they be interested in dealing with promoting biodiversity off their land?
Well, the farm is part of a bigger landscape. And so if you have any kind of crop that needs pollination, there are native wild pollinators moving from wild habitat into your farm, and in some types of crops doing amazing amount of pollination. Overall, pollination is worth $40 billion of orchard, row, and pasture business in the U.S. As an example, but there's also other types of species moving through, like barn owls and bats that eat pest rodents for the barn owls and pest insects that the bats eat, and also other insectivorous birds that are moving through. But there's also water coming through your land. It's not like it just magically appears. Well, I guess it could come out from a spring, but in most cases, water is moving through, and so you, as a farmer, most farmers want to be good stewards. They don't want to have a lot of sediment and any kind of fertilizer runoff from their farm impacting the next farm down below, and or having bad neighbors above them. So there's all these different watershed connections that make the farm part of a bigger ecosystem.
Now, let's bring Tim Franklin, manager of the Yale Creek Ranch, back in here. So, Tim, let's take a little bit of what Joanne was discussing there and see how it relates down on Yale Creek Ranch. Do you guys do any biodiversity conservation promotion off your 85 acres, but in the immediately surrounding area?
We do some. We work with other neighbors and local watershed restoration groups, as well as now some of the Natural Resources Conservation Service. We work with them on some of these riparian or streamside restoration projects. Our neighbors above and below us on the river now have recently fenced livestock out of the stream and are doing restoration of native revegetation communities similar to what we're doing. We work with them on water conservation projects as well and on managing our irrigation withdrawals and our irrigation diversions to conserve to the extent that we can water and keep as much water as we can in the stream. So those are a couple examples.
Do you have any idea what species you are having a positive impact for?
Sure. Yeah, I think we're having a positive impact for lots of species. The ones in the stream here, Little Applegate River and Yale Creek next to our ranch, steelhead and resident cutthroat and rainbow, and of course others like sculpin and lamprey, and just downstream from us is the upstream limit of Chinook and coho salmon. We've got, of course, we live in a mix of pasture and oak woodlands as well as croplands, so oak woodlands are incredibly rich in their biodiversity. We've got an endangered species, Gentner's fritillaria, that we have habitat for that on the ranch, and quite a variety of other species that use oak woodlands. And then just off up in the woods as it grades into more conifer-dominated forests, you have critters like the spotted owl.
Okay. Now, one of the pages here in the new Wild Farm Alliance publication, so this is the section, Biodiversity When Livestock Are Involved, Employing Wildlife-Friendly Management Practices. And another issue, aside from erosion and stream destruction, specifically with cattle and cows, and invasive species, I think a common third assumption related to livestock ranching is ranchers kill potential threats of predators, wolves, for example, cougars, etc., possibly bear, I don't know. Is that anything that you guys ever have to deal with in that part of the state? Predators for your livestock?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we've got plenty of predators here. And
what type?
Well, bears and mountain lions, coyotes, bobcats, skunks.
Now,
fox,
in a lot of cases,
pair of golden eagles.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I see a golden eagle like swooping down and taking a lamb or something. But
oh, but they've taken a lot of our chickens.
Oh, okay. Sure. Right. Yeah. Right. 85 acres, including chickens. So, not to put you too much on the spot, but did you ever kill any of the predators?
No, good. Put us in the spot.
Okay.
Actually.
So, what do you do instead?
We ought to get some credit for the amount of feed we've donated to the local wildlife population.
Right, right.
In fact, here's what we do. The main, we've got our pastures divided up, as I said. We've got a lot of smaller pocket pastures in close to the barns and outbuildings, areas where we can keep an eye on our livestock, and that ends up being where we concentrate our sheep and chicken flocks. We had them out on the larger pastures farther away from the intense activity around the crops and around the buildings. But we were losing too many chickens to the local golden eagles. So the chickens and the sheep rotate in where we can keep an eye on them, and they both go in at night. The cattle, the herd's large enough where predators tend not to be such a problem. We are out and active in those pastures, irrigating or doing one thing or another enough that our presence tends to help as well, I believe. But we haven't had a predator problem with the cattle. There are enough of them, and they're big enough, and we keep them on the move, that they pretty much take care of themselves. So those are some of the strategies we use.
Okay, now, Joanne, this publication is fairly newly out, and it's part of the National Organic Program. Any sense of... I'm just a slightly bit confused. Do all people pursuing organic certification have to show that they are doing this, or is this something that... It's like, okay, yeah, you're organically certified, and here's this stuff that you're supposed to be doing and report on once in a while.
Well, every site is different, and the rule requires biodiversity conservation, but obviously some places the biodiversity is just about extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And so farmers are not expected to turn it back into some wildland. But to do what they can. So, for instance, a farmer in the Central Valley of California, where in places can be very sterile, is putting in a hedgerow, a native plant hedgerow. But in any case, this guide is just now being sent to all the 9,000 or so organic farmers in the country. And a similar guide has been created specifically for certifiers and is being sent out to all the organic certifiers in the country. So it's really support for farmers to start to address this issue. It's new to a lot of farmers, and the USDA head has said that he's going to be incorporating biodiversity into his trainings he does with certification agencies. So it is in the rule, and it's just a matter of people getting up to speed.
Okay, well, cool. I am going to thank you both very much for joining us this morning to talk a little bit about how organic farmers and ranchers can help promote biodiversity conservation. I have been speaking with Joanne Baumgartner. She's the director of the Wild Farm Alliance. You can find out more about them online at www.wildfarmalliance.org. And we've also been speaking with Tim Franklin, the ranch manager down at the Yale Creek Ranch at Yale Creek and Little Applegate River in southern Oregon. Thank you both very much for speaking with us this morning about this.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, take care.
You too.
And you can find out more about them and everything we talked about this morning here on the program at kboo.fm. If you click on programs, go to the schedule, Wednesday morning at 10, People Rise Up brings you to my webpage, which is chock full of all sorts of interesting reading connected to these topics. And the Biodiversity Conservation Guide itself, and I guess they're going to post this online soon, has dozens and dozens of really fascinating internet site web links related to that topic there, talking about farmers and ranchers promoting biodiversity. If you have any comments or questions about anything you heard today or any other day on this program, feel free to send me email, kboo@riseup.net. That's RISEUP.net. You can also send regular paper mail to me here, Andrew Geller, KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I appreciate you listening, and this program will be posted online at radioforall.net. And do a search for my name and see the entire archive. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you very much for listening to the program today, and whenever you have in the past, feel free to tell other folks you know who might enjoy listening about this online resource. Want to wish everybody a happy and safe new year, and also let folks know that in the coming year, and possibly as soon as next week, I'm going to be producing a many, many part series, at least 15 parts. It may go up to 18. I'm not entirely sure yet. And what it's going to focus on are the 14 common characteristics throughout time of fascist states. There's been a scientific, politically scientific, examination by a social scientist who came up with a list of 14 common characteristics of all fascist states throughout time. And I am going to do a thorough analysis as to whether or not the United States government portrays and exhibits these behaviors and to what extent they do, examining each one in its own program next year. So do stay tuned for that.